sit at my table.
Dignity.
Security.
Freedom.
Freedom.
Respect.
Justice.
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 Equality.
Equality.
Remedy.
Succession.
Fairness.
Fair time.
Citizens.
Right.
Will.
Peace.
Losers.
Men.
It's my mistake. Let me make it good. I raised the wall, and I will be the one to knock it down.
Asylum,
identity,
family,
home,
conscience,
expression,
expression.
Expression,
expression,
participation,
democracy,
welfare,
work,
work,
leisure,
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 health,
education,
focus,
culture,
human rights,
Charter Dana,
solidarity,
responsibility.
Fill in the mortar. I raise the wall, and I'm the only one. I will be the one to knock it down.
And good afternoon to all of our listeners on CJTR Community Radio at 91.3 FM, and welcome to everyone tuning in over the internet at cjtr.ca. We can also be heard on SaskTel Max at channel 806 and Access Communications Digital Service at channel 341. Wherever you are, welcome to Human Rights Radio, hosted weekly by Amnesty International volunteers, who are a worldwide movement of people dedicated to the promotion of human rights and the safety of all human beings. We're building a world in which every person enjoys the rights included in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other human rights standards. Our theme song is titled 30 Words, The Universal Declaration of Human Rights, written and performed by REM and a collection of musicians from around the world. My name is Jim Hutchings, and today I'm joined by my co-host Gord Barnes, and today we're going to talk about the recently released Amnesty International Report 2013. But before we do that, I want to talk about something that's happening here at the station. It's actually probably my favorite event of the year at the station. It's CJTR's annual Music Garage Sale, and I really enjoy this event for a couple of reasons, one of which I enjoy meeting people who come here and check out our stuff, and sometimes we get to introduce them to the radio station, and it really catches their interest, and we end up with a new programmer or somebody who's really interested in helping out with the station. But the main reason that you should be coming here is that we've got lots of CDs, DVDs, and equipment, stereo equipment, music stuff, that sort of thing. So it's going to be happening on Saturday, June the 8th. Now, the other side of that is that we need some donations. We've got a room full of them already, but we always like to have as many as we possibly can. So what we're asking you to do is, if you've got CDs, DVDs, working stereo equipment, sheet music, or other music-related items that you no longer want or need, please consider donating them to us, your community radio station. You can drop your items by the station at 1102 8th Avenue during our business hours, Monday to Friday from 9 to 5, or give us a call at 525-7274 and arrange for pickup. Our annual Music Garage Sale is a major fundraiser for Regina Community Radio, and your support is greatly needed and appreciated. So just to recap here, our Music Garage Sale is going to be held on the main floor here at 1102 8th Avenue on Saturday, June 8th, from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. I know everybody here looks forward to it, and you never know what kind of treasures you're going to find in terms of CDs or anything. You just don't know what you're going to find, and you'll probably meet some new friends here too as well.
It's a great way to support, as you mentioned, Jim, community radio, and you know I'm going to probably spend some time over the weekend sorting through things at home, and I know I've got some old records that I'm going to drop in and some old CDs that I'm going to donate, probably drop them off when I'm here next week for the program. I'm always very appreciative of the opportunity to support community radio. I just love the programming on this station, on CJTR. The variety of music and also spoken word programs is just fabulous.
It's unique.
Yeah.
It's unique, that's for sure. And if we want it to continue, then we have to support it. You know, it's not here for any other reason than we want it to be here, and we're willing to support it. So do your part, folks, and if you've got donations, bring them on down, and then come on down on Saturday, June the 8th, and see what you can find. There's treasure here. There is absolute treasure here. Yeah, for sure. Anyway, we're talking
back to our topic of the you mentioned recently released annual report for Amnesty International, and it was actually just released yesterday, Thursday, May 23rd. It's the annual report. It's called Annual Report 2013, but it actually refers to what has happened in countries around the world in the year 2012. This is a major initiative that Amnesty International, through our worldwide movement, undertakes every year. The release of the report is a significant event because it really pulls together all the research that people have undertaken and all the various concerns that Amnesty has around the world. Certainly one of the significant themes of this year's annual report is that this has become a very dangerous world for people who are refugees and migrants, increasingly so. It documents that currently there are 15 million people who are actually registered as refugees. We know that the number is much higher, but that's the number that are people who are actually registered. In addition, there are about 12 million people who were stateless at the beginning of 2012, meaning that they literally did not have a home, a country that they could call home.
Wow.
Some other significant sort of, you might say, key bits of information in the report, in terms of the highlights that I'd mention in terms of facts and figures in the report. And these are really difficult, in some cases, numbers to hear, and yet serves to remind us of the importance of the international movement and our campaign to prevent serious human rights abuses. Amnesty International has actually recorded and documented that 112 countries tortured their citizens in 2012, and 101 countries repressed people's right to freedom of expression in the same year. 80 countries conducted unfair trials, and prisoners of conscience were detained in 57 countries. What that means is people who have been detained either because of their political or religious or other opinions have been detained in 57 countries. One of the positive things that did happen more recently that is referenced in the report is that 155 states voted to adopt the Arms Trade Treaty at the UN General Assembly. Now, that just took place in April 2013. Three countries voted against the treaty, but there is a need to continue to work on that whole campaign around the Arms Trade Treaty.
So that needs to be ratified, though, right?
That's right, and that process will begin later in June of this year. Another significant bit of information that's available in the report is that there were more than two-thirds of countries worldwide now that are abolitionist, meaning that they do not have the death penalty in their law or in practice by the end of 2012. More than two-thirds of the countries, meaning about 140 countries. A downside is that security forces were actually responsible for unlawful killings in peacetime in 50 countries. And men, women, and children faced forced evictions in 36 countries. And in another 31 countries, people were forcibly disappeared. So those are some of the high-level kinds of facts and figures that are documented in the report. I think we're going to share a video that Amnesty International has actually put together to mark the release of the report. Just mention that the report itself is available for purchase, and I know many libraries, schools will often purchase it, individuals. It's also available online. It's very accessible. You can go to the amnesty.ca site and find it quite readily. One of the things that this report over the years has become really is the reference point for people who are either students, academics, activists, and other people who are working on various projects relative to countries around the world, and a significant reference point. So I'd encourage people to take a look at it, and maybe, Jim, are we ready to share that video? Does that work for us?
Yeah, we're ready. I just wanted to make one more point, though, that this is about as unbiased a report as you're going to get, because Amnesty is not funded by any government organizations, nobody with an axe to grind, so you're getting the straight goods of about as factually as you're going to get from anyone.
That's right, yeah.
All righty, well, through the magic of computers, let's see if we can... we can play this. This is a video that's about the annual report.
The scale of the destruction is almost unimaginable. Towns and villages destroyed. Lives destroyed.
This is the home of the Alwani family, where seven people, the father, the mother, and five sons were killed. People are saying that the number of those injured is very high, and they are mostly children, and who ended up being killed and injured in the very place they went to look for safety.
Syria. The conflict has led around 4 million people to flee their homes. More than 1.4 million more have left the country altogether and are now mainly in neighboring countries, many in refugee camps.
The war was happening in front of us. It wasn't good anymore. So we came here, with war happening on top of our heads. We hope it'll be better for us here. The most important thing is to be safe. We don't need much more.
And they are not alone. Around the world, millions of the most vulnerable are being failed by their governments and the international community.
Syria is, of course, in the media at the moment, but it's not the only place where refugees are coming from. There are about 50 million refugees in the world. Some of them come from Somalia, they come from Afghanistan, there are Palestinian refugees and Rohingya refugees, and all of them live in very difficult circumstances and do not know when they will be able to go home.
Mali, and in fighting for control of the north of the country, hundreds have died, thousands have fled. Wherever there's conflict and people forced to flee for safety, women and girls seem to be at greatest risk. Rape and sexual violence are a real threat.
Mm-hmm.
They threaten me with a gun. If you don't give them your money, they kill you. If you wouldn't give them what they want, they would also rape you.
The paradox is that it's harder for the refugees to cross borders than it is for the guns that fuel the violence and insecurity. But 2 months ago in New York, 20 years of public pressure on the world's governments finally led to the adoption of an arms trade treaty that aims to stop shipments of weapons where they may be used for human rights violations.
L58 is adopted.
We have a lot of hopes for the arms trade treaty. We think that it really will stop the irresponsible flow of arms to those who use it to commit atrocities. But we need to remember, people cross borders for many reasons, not just to escape violence. Sometimes they're trying to escape poverty. And what we see are migrants crossing borders, sometimes with papers, sometimes without. And once they do that, being stripped of their rights and exploited.
Plenty of countries want cheap labor, but don't seem prepared to recognize that every migrant worker has rights. A laborer is also a human being. He also has his own way of living. He's not some animal who can be imprisoned and suppressed in order to extract work. The economic exodus means that tens of millions of people are on the move from country to country. Europe is investing millions of euros in protecting its borders. The side effect is, those trying to enter are often detained, discriminated against, and denied their fundamental human rights. When it comes to policing borders and dealing with migrants, there are governments claiming they have the right to act as they see fit in the interests of their people. But they forget that human rights are fundamental and non-negotiable.
The world is becoming an increasingly dangerous place for refugees, migrants, displaced people in general. So the international community, political leaders, have to accept shared responsibility to protect the rights of these millions of people who are displaced and pushed out of their homes.
So that gives you a bit of a taste of some of the issues covered off in the annual report, but it's only a bit of a introduction to it all. Certainly, as I mentioned before, the whole concern with respect to the rights of people and the plight of people who are either migrants or refugees makes is a significant theme throughout the report, but it's not the only thing. And I guess just to reference some of the things in more detail, it's worth noting that in the Middle East, the armed conflict, as has been mentioned, in Syria, has left large numbers of people dead, and many people as refugees. Unfortunately, in parts of Yemen, there continues to be significant levels of violence between government forces and armed forces. In 2012, the Israeli government continued policies of collective punishment of people in the occupied Palestinian territories, and included within this the blockade of the Gaza Strip and restrictions on Palestinian movement in the West Bank. And in, people will recall that in November 2012, Israel launched an 8-day military campaign against Palestinian armed groups that fire indiscriminate rockets from Gaza into Israel. During that time, six Israelis and more than 160 Palestinians were killed during the conflict. The majority of those people were civilians. Also in the Middle East, in terms of the threats against freedom of expression and assembly, in Iran there was a continuing concern with respect to the repression of dissidents, of journalists, many people who have been in jail now for several years, and all this is in a lead up to the presidential election that's scheduled for June of this year.
Yeah, and that's kind of interesting in itself. I mean, proof positive that it is a theocracy there. The the president that we've learned to dislike or wonder about his comments and all the rest of it, is not being allowed to run this year.
Yeah, and you know, it's very, very concerning that even a person now who has, we've mentioned on the program before, Hamid Ghassami Shall, who's a Canadian citizen, has Iranian citizenship as well, went back to Iran a few years ago to visit family, visit his mother who wasn't well, was arrested and continues to be held in jail in Evin prison, and is facing the death penalty. And, you know, that really has been through a very unfair process relative to the trial, has not committed any crime relative to violence, and yet this is a person who, as I say, is a Canadian citizen. We're encouraging the government of Canada to speak out with respect to the issues in Iran, and particularly that case. And we need to continue to the pressure around that to create more awareness of what's going on there. One of the other areas it's worth noting in the report is some of the significant human rights concerns in Africa, where armed conflict escalated across the continent, including in the Democratic Republic of Congo, also in Mali and Sudan. And in those countries, it was the civilian population that bore the brunt of the violence, and thousands were displaced. Amnesty documented the human rights, gross human rights abuses were committed by many armed groups and security forces in those countries. Unfortunately, people were also displaced en masse by communal violence in Kenya, Nigeria, and South Sudan. And in Cote d'Ivoire, an estimated 13,000 people were displaced by violent incidents in villages along the Liberian border. Amazing to note that in the year 2012, the use of child soldiers was documented in Somalia, Mali, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and also in Chad. Another concern in the African portion of the annual report was that discrimination against people because of their real or perceived sexual orientation or gender identity actually worsened across the continent. In Cameroon, there was an increase in the number of and frequency of arrests, and in Uganda there were fresh attempts to pass a controversial bill to significantly increase penalties associated with same-sex sexual conduct. And significantly as well, women in areas of armed conflict were subject to high levels of sexual violence. Many governments continued their assault on freedom of expression in Africa, including in countries such as Ethiopia, Rwanda, and Sudan, where human rights activists themselves experienced increased surveillance. And in Gambia, Nigeria, and South Sudan, journalists were harassed, intimidated, and imprisoned. And 18 journalists were killed, 18 journalists in Somalia.
It's a dangerous occupation.
It is. And of significant concern is that the death penalty was imposed in several countries. And in one worrying move, the Gambia actually carried out its first executions in 30 years, which is a step backwards. The use of torture by police and security forces remained widespread, with cases reported in Ethiopia, Nigeria, Senegal, and Zimbabwe, and arbitrary arrests were common in most of those countries. This gives you a kind of a taste, I guess, mm-hmm. of some of the concerns that Amnesty International's got, and going through it by region, it sort of gives you a sample of the, you know, the work that we need to undertake as civil society organizations, not just people who are you know, human rights activists within Amnesty International, but everybody around the world needs to turn their attention to what's happening in terms of significant human rights abuses.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, for sure. And of course, the main way that we do that is letter writing.
Right. And, you know, the research and the letter writing is always been, first of all, the research is always well documented, but also the letter writing itself is often something that people ask about, is how effective it is it. And in the annual report, there's even reference to one of the people who was viciously attacked in Tahrir Square in Egypt, a woman who was one of the 12 cases featured in December 2012 with our Right for Rights campaign. And this woman said, "One thing that gives us hope is the support and solidarity from regular people. People are the only impetus for change. Governments will not do anything unless there's pressure from people. The amount of messages I receive from Amnesty International activists gives me so much hope, despite all the challenges." So I think we're going to go to the break now. Is
yes,
that
we are.
Close?
And then we've got some Michael Franti on the other side.
All right.
Okay, so we'll be right back.
Sunshine coming down.
and that was my favorite, Michael Franti. He's an interesting guy, you know.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I noticed I was reading earlier this week where Michael Franti has raised concern again about the continued use of drones, which he said, you know, are basically bombs. There's no significant difference. By the American government, by the United States government, and you know, while they will leave people to believe that they're, you know, very well targeted, it's been acknowledged even by the American government that in many cases there have been significant civilian casualties, and we need to recognize Michael Franti for raising this as a public issue and a significant human rights concern.
Yeah, and that's the thing. For some reason or other, these military officials and governments, they're quite willing to accept what they call collateral damage. Oh, a few civilians got killed. That's too bad. We got the guys we want, or maybe they didn't. But they're willing to accept it, and that's so troubling.
Yeah. So I think, Jim, it's probably worth taking a few minutes. And one of the questions many people will often ask us is, what does that Amnesty International report, that annual report, say with respect to Canada? And, you know, I know many friends I have, when they get the report, will actually turn there first just to see what it says and what some of the concerns are. And if you wanted to share that, I think it's a good time in the program to do that.
Okay. And I know what you mean, Gordon. Sometimes it seems a little ironic that our government that talks a pretty good game in terms of human rights for other countries. When you start looking at Canada itself, we don't fare that well in the report. For example, in 2012 there were continuing systematic violations of the rights of Indigenous peoples, immigration and refugee law reforms that violated international human rights norms. For example, in January, hearings began before a government-appointed review panel to consider a proposal to build a pipeline connecting the Alberta oil sands and the British Columbia coast. The controversial Northern Gateway project would pass through or near a little misprint here. Anyway, they've expressed public opposition. And in February, the federal government acknowledged before the Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination Committee that the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples could be used when interpreting Canadian laws, but took no steps to work with Indigenous peoples to implement the declaration. And that's one of the things that's happened, is the Canadian government has signed on to the declaration, but we haven't seen any results yet.
Yeah.
In February, the government introduced the Safe Drinking Water for First Nations Act, which was a good thing. But the Act's regulations provide no additional resources for water infrastructure in First Nations communities. So I suppose it's a first step to recognize that there's a problem, and now we need some cash because it costs money. In April, the federal court overturned a 2011 Canadian Human Rights Tribunal ruling dismissing a discrimination complaint regarding public spending on child protection in First Nation communities as compared to predominantly non-Indigenous communities. The case was before the Federal Court of Appeal at the end of the year. Legislative changes in 2012 dramatically restricted federal environmental impact assessments. The government had claimed that these assessments were crucial for fulfilling its constitutional obligation towards Indigenous peoples. Can you clarify that a little bit, Gord, that court thing? I think basically, so we had a 2000 ruling from the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal dismissed a discrimination complaint regarding public spending and child protection. So it basically came out on the side of?
Yeah, it's actually an ongoing case. Initially, as you noted, the case had been thrown out, but it's back before the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal currently. And one of the things that's happened more recently is a concern's been raised that through that process, that court process, first of all, The federal government has not shared all the information that has available with the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal around that whole issue.
Right.
And that's one of the obligations they have. And the other thing is that, you know, they're basically standing in the way of resolving a fundamental human rights concern, where kids who go to school on reserve get less support in terms of their education than kids who go to school off reserve. I mean, that's so basic that I think most Canadians would say, hey, this has got to be dealt with, and there shouldn't be a need to take that to court or address it through a process that is so first of all contentious, but also essentially one that throws up a lot of barriers. And it is, frankly, an expensive process because the federal government is spending a lot of money to defend its own position and yet failing to address the serious concern, which I think people in most provincial governments across Canada have a concern with respect to this. And we need to really continue to raise this issue with our members of parliament across Canada to
It needs to be discussed. And I sort of understand now what the government's position is on this. And their attitude is, well, we spend the same amount of money on Aboriginal kids as we do on non-Aboriginal. But what they fail to take into account is how much more expensive it is to deliver these services to the Aboriginal children. So there's no additional money to do that. So that's kind of subtracted from the whole thing, and that's why Aboriginal children don't end up with as much resources as they should.
And actually, the funding levels themselves on a per capita basis are not equitable.
They're not.
That's something to keep in mind as well. So, you know, there's some really good information both on the amnesty.ca site relative to that, but also if you go to this website for the First Nations Child and Caring Society, their Have a Heart campaign really provides people good background information on that issue, and we'd encourage people to take a look at that and become more informed. It really is a matter of equity for kids who are going to school getting appropriate levels of support for their education. So there's some other things that were referenced in the in the report with respect to Canada, and it's probably worth
Here's one that I'm particularly interested in. It's an ongoing story of Ashley Smith, who was a 19-year-old who died in an Ontario provincial jail in 2007. I think we still have an inquest continuing doing
that. That's right.
And it's just a litany of the system failing Ashley Smith, and no doubt she's a difficult young lady to deal with, but there should have been a way to avoid her death under the circumstances in which she died. The report, we also have a report of a British Columbia inquiry into the police response to cases of missing and murdered women, many of whom were Indigenous, and that was released in December. And Amnesty International and other organizations were critical of the inquiry's failure to ensure the full and effective participation of affected communities. So they have an inquiry, but they don't allow full participation. So this really is unfair, and you're not going to get a proper outcome if you don't allow everyone to participate. And what else do we have here? Counterterror and Security, the Military Police Complaints Commission, released a report in June clearing individual military police officers of fault but pointing to systemic failings with respect to the transfer of prisoners in Afghanistan to the custody of Afghan officials. This is kind of an old story, but it just won't lie down, I guess. In August, a ministerial direction from 2011 was made public instructing the Royal Canadian Mounted Police and the Canadian Border Services Agency in cases involving a serious threat to public safety to make use of foreign intelligence that may have been obtained through torture and to share information with foreign governments, even if doing so would give rise to a substantial risk of torture. It just seems like a road we shouldn't be going down. Another development, finally in September, Omer Khadr, a Canadian citizen who was apprehended by U.S. forces in Afghanistan in 2002, when he was 15, and detained at Guantanamo Bay since was transferred to a Canadian prison. Further to 2011 plea deal, he had been eligible for transfer for 11 months. So we finally managed to get Omer Khadr back on Canadian soil. And we haven't heard too much about him lately. I don't know what's going on there now.
Yeah, we're continuing to campaign for his release. He, as you noted, he was a child soldier and at the time, and when he was arrested in Afghanistan, Canadian citizen, and it took a long time for the Canadian government to recognize that they have a responsibility to Omer Khadr as a Canadian citizen, and raise their concerns, the concerns of Canadians, with the American government relative to their continued detainment of him at Guantanamo Bay.
There was actually a court order that the government had to deal with the situation properly, and it was still quite some time before anything happened.
That's right, yeah.
With regard to refugees and asylum seekers, in June, that would be June of last year, legislation was passed requiring mandatory detention of asylum seekers arriving in Canada in an irregular manner. So that would be like the boatloads that sometimes end up coming into Vancouver. Hmm. And who knows how they got on there. They probably paid unscrupulous business people huge dollars to get crammed onto an old, you know, scow of a vessel that can just barely sail. And it's a very, very dangerous process. So now what's happening is they've passed this legislation requiring everyone who arrives in that manner to be detained. And so it denies access to the refugee appeal division to such individuals, as well as to refugee claimants coming from designated safe countries of origin. So if the government says, in their estimation, a country is safe, it's very difficult, if not impossible, for a refugee coming from that country to claim refugee status.
And in those cases, you know, you referenced the situation where people were arriving on boats on the West Coast. Those people were often arriving from Sri Lanka, and you know, that country had gone through years of very significant civil war, and there were people on both sides of the conflict who had to flee. If they did pay money to find a safe refuge somewhere in the world, and then get detained. Often it was men, but also many cases women and children that had to flee. And the idea that now they don't have access to appropriate process to have their refugee claim considered is really unfortunate.
And when you mention Sri Lanka, I think they still have refugee camps there, don't they?
Yes, that's right.
And
yeah.
Everyone seems to be ignoring that situation. And again, this is where letter writing comes in.
Yeah.
I don't know whether you have a current action in the works, but the people who were displaced by all the fighting, if you weren't on the right side of the ethnic boundary there, you end up in a camp which you cannot leave.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it makes it very, very difficult. And the government, the Sri Lankan government, is not being transparent about what is going to happen to these people, what their plans are. They're just keeping them there.
Yeah.
So we're not sure what's going on there. In June, the government introduced new legislation which would strip large numbers of permanent residents with criminal records of the ability to appeal or seek humanitarian relief from deportation orders. So I suppose these are people that they've been in Canada for a while, but some sort of criminal record from their past has surfaced, but they're given no way of appealing those particular findings.
That's right.
Just deported and that's it. So that is a little drastic. And also in June, the government instituted drastic cuts to the interim federal health program for refugees. And we're kind of familiar with that here in Saskatchewan because the provincial government stepped in on one particular case up in Saskatoon.
And actually, the provincial government has, to its credit here, said that if refugees do need health care here in Saskatchewan, this was previously something that was looked after by the federal government, that the provincial government will undertake and accept that responsibility. And they are continuing to say to the federal government, you know, this is something that Canada needs to be responsible for.
Right, right.
I think we also need to acknowledge the very significant work that physicians and also other healthcare professionals across Canada are doing on this issue, because they're raising it continually as a public issue that people who have come to Canada as refugees, either as have claimed refugee status or been accepted as refugees, need to be provided appropriate levels of health care, and that's absolutely crucial. And you know, in some cases, people do need some pretty basic stuff, but also at times counseling. You know, personally, I can recall many years ago, I worked with the Regina Open Doors Society, and I met a family who had been accepted as refugees when they first arrived in Canada, you know, and they had come from Nicaragua. They had fled that country when there was a terrible conflict going there. They fled for their lives, and young husband and wife arrived in Regina, and they had a very young baby. And the baby, I think, likely simply because of the situation they were in just prior to when they left, and then the whole business of even traveling, you know, how many people have to do that with their young babies and go through that kind of conflict and then travel. The young baby needed some pretty quick medical care, and they had arrived on Friday at the end of the day. You don't actually get your official card, you know, till you can get over to the office and get your health card, but you know, I need to acknowledge that we were able to find a doctor in Regina who fortunately spoke Spanish, and that doctor was wonderful and provided support over the course of the weekend for the baby, and things turned out well. But can you imagine if people don't have access to that kind of health care who are refugees? It'd just be terrible.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's kind of reminiscent of what it's like to be living in the States if you don't have health care, and what's the percentage of people down there who do not have health care of any kind?
Yeah.
On the same, going along the line of refugee status, in September, there's a girl by the name of Kimberly Rivera whose claim for refugee status based on her desertion from the U.S. military for reasons of conscience was rejected. And she was deported to the USA, where she was arrested. And she was confined to Fort Carson Army Base awaiting court-martial at the end of the year. To me, that begs the question, why does our government have to get involved in disciplining you know, members of the U.S. Army? It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. And it's contrary to, you know, years ago during the Vietnam War, there were many people who did not feel they wanted to, Americans who did not want to participate in the military activities in Vietnam, and the government of Canada did allow many people who who were Americans at that time to come into to Canada. Unfortunately, the government currently isn't taking that approach. And,
and of course, I suppose there's a difference between avoiding the draft and actually deserting. Because I think that if you were a deserter in Canada at that time, you weren't necessarily home free.
No, there were some significant challenges back then as well.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Another thing that's happened here under the heading of police and security forces, emergency legislation limiting freedom of expression and assembly was enacted in the province of Quebec in May to response to mass student demonstrations. It was suspended in September following a change of government. The government did not respond to calls for a public inquiry into police abuses during the demonstrations. And in May, the Office of the Independent Police Review Director in the province of Ontario recommended disciplinary proceedings against 36 police officers for offenses associated with the policing of demonstrations at the G20 summit in Toronto in 2010. And we were there. We were there, and fortunately we didn't end up getting penned up in one of these temporary jails or anything like that, but it was more good luck than good management, Gord. We could have been there, yeah. You know?
Yeah.
Because we opted not to go to Queen's Park at the end of the march, and people who stayed in Queen's Park, and that included elderly people, families, children, they ended up seeing policemen on horses charging through the park, driving them out.
Yeah.
This almost seems unimaginable in our Canada, but it's what our Canada, unfortunately, seems to have become. And a few other things here. Corporate accountability in May. That would be May of last year, I guess. Yes. A mandated report was released assessing the human rights impacts of the Canada-Columbia Free Trade Agreement, which had entered into force in August 2011. The government claimed it was too early to assess the impacts. In November, the Supreme Court refused to hear an appeal in a case brought against a Canadian mining company for alleged responsibility for human rights abuses in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Lower courts had ruled that Canada was not the appropriate jurisdiction in which to hear the case. Well, I guess it begs the question, where's the appropriate the appropriate jurisdiction?
Mm.
You know, we've got Canadian companies, and these things are happening as a result of Canadian activities. And that's about it. That's sort of the highlights.
That's the Canadian section of the annual report. And,
right.
You know, that portion of it and the things we were talking about before the program break in the first half hour give you a kind of taste of all the various human rights concerns that Amnesty has documented in our annual report. You know, in the foreword and in the very beginning of the report, there's a quote by Martin Luther King Jr., and it's quite a famous one, and I just want to share this in the conclusion of the program. This is taken from his letter from Birmingham Jail from April 16th, 1963, and of course, no one will ever be as eloquent as Martin Luther King Jr., but he said at the time that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere, and we are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects us all indirectly. And that's certainly a good way to, you know, begin our annual report, and keep that in mind as you're hearing about the range of human rights concerns that Amnesty International has documented.
Yep, and it going back to the G20, when we saw all the police presence there, all the fences, all the extraordinary things that happened there, you think we're not that far removed from every day seeing that sort of thing. It's possible.
Yeah.
So we have to basically have to keep on paying attention and being activists. And we've run out of time, Gordon. So we're going to close this week's Human Rights Radio on CJTR Community Radio. We hope you've enjoyed listening to and have learned something new about human rights for all people. For info on past and upcoming shows with links to human rights actions and information, go to amnestysaskatchewan.ca. Peter Benenson, founder of Amnesty International, said, "It's better to light a candle of hope than to curse the darkness."